You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 30th of March, 2022. I know that I've been neck deep in the situation in Ukraine for the last few weeks, and to be honest, at this point, unless something huge occurs, I've said all I have to say about it. It's underwhelming in a lot of respects. And what would have made it more interesting if, you know, if NATO had been directly involved. They were indirectly involved. And I've been through all of this and why this is important. But I'm not going to do that today. I'm going to do something only tangentially related to it. As always, though, I do ask for your assistance in financially, on my site on Radio Albion site, my blog on there has places to buy my books and my Patreon, as well as direct donations, which is something that I need more and more as time goes on. But one of the things that I'm known for, and I think it made me famous or infamous over the years, has been taking obscure figures and explaining them in some detail. Figures that were important in the Eastern world but are almost completely insignificant today. People who deserve a wider audience. And you can go back and you could see this laundry list of people that I brought to the forefront, who in the past were almost entirely, at least in the West, entirely ignored. Today I want to talk about Simeon Frank. Even among Russia specialists, he doesn't come up very much. And you're going to see in a little while why that's the case. He didn't start off this way like so many of these guys. He started off as a leftist and abandoned it as he saw what it was capable of. But what makes him more significant from our point of view, and the reason why he's not spoken of very often, is that he was a Jew. He was born to a medical family, and in fact was born an Orthodox Jew. His father died at a young age, and his grandfather finished his studies for him. But he didn't remain a Jew. In fact, became Russian Orthodox in the beginning of the 20th century. And for that reason alone, he deserves more attention. Again, he was a communist in the beginning and had no problem later on talking about the Jewish almost obsession with Marxism. He remained a socialist, but became, well, like myself, became more of an idealist than anything else. He was expelled from the Russian Empire, finished his studies, University of Berlin, and while there, around the turn of the century, began to criticize Marx pretty substantially. He, I believe it was 1912, he converted to the Russian Orthodox Church, and in fact, from there on in, began teaching metaphysics at the main university in Petrograd. And he clearly rejected the Talmud and became a bit of a, and maybe almost up to his conversion, remained somewhat of a Karaite. And he thought that the Old Testament only makes sense in the in the light of Christ. We're going to talk about this a bit more, but it's no accident that he became very interested in Spinoza. Many of you have been a little curious as to why for so many years I pored over the texts of Baruch Spinoza. And there's good reason for that. Now, Frank, as he was lecturing in the Russian Empire, and of course was later removed from the USSR, ended up, it's irritating that it was the World Council of Churches that assisted him, was removed from the USSR after he received his Saratov degree at the University of Saratov there. In 1921, he even went to Moscow University. It was the summer of 22. He was removed from the country on the so-called philosopher's ship. The Soviets didn't murder these guys, but the intellectuals were put on a, Berdyaev was one of them, and removed from the country permanently. He became an idealist. He removed himself, and this is the case with a lot of people in that era, you know, Berdyaev even included, that the materialism of the materialist assumptions of Karl Marx were these assumptions were intolerable. Nothing made sense to him without a conception of the soul. And the soul is defined by him as the center, the unity, the focus, the heart of psychic life. I'm choosing my words very carefully. Unfortunately, not a whole lot of his stuff is available in English. I don't think. I actually haven't looked. But I'm being very careful what words I use directly from the Russian. Idealists are concerned both with metaphysics and epistemology because they're two sides of the same coin. Epistemology concerns knowledge and how we know that we know something. What are the criteria by which we actually can make the statement that we know X? But for him, knowledge was based on an inner awareness. There's a Heideggerian element here, almost an empathy between the subject and whatever it is that we're trying to understand. There's an interest, very much a care in Heidegger's system, a very similar idea. But he didn't accept idealism without criticism. Frank was incapable of this. Immanuel Kant, now when I was in grad school, I took two high-level courses, a doctoral level on Immanuel Kant, first on his critique of pure reason and then on his critique of practical reason. And for whatever reason, Kant really agreed with me. Now, I don't accept a lot of his conclusions, but the way he wrote and the way he framed problems, I ended up blowing through those classes easily, which is saying quite a bit. For Immanuel Kant, to put it in the most simple terms, we know things via representation. He opened up the door for people like Hegel and Schopenhauer much later. But the thing itself is beyond our reach. This was his great revolutionary understanding. The world out there is chaotic. Our minds contain the categories. And that's how we know things. So here's the difference. Someone like John Locke, an empiricist, nominalist, just takes it for granted that there are things external to us. We then perceive those things, and through a slow, painstaking process of putting qualities together to form objects and objects to form systems, we almost construct a world. But the world is really out there in pieces. And that's what the brain does. It's like a stage. There's no preconditions. It is a blank slate. And that's called dogmatism in the history of metaphysics. The belief, the assumption that things external to us are simply external to us, and we see what's actually out there and nothing more. Idealism, or the critique, which is why Kant refers to his two major books as critiques, is to deny this. Reality is constructed from entities already in the brain, already in the mind, I should say. Whatever is out there is unknowable or at least unprovable. You can't prove to me the existence of matter. You can't prove to me the existence of external phenomena, because you have no idea if they're in fact external. Westerners take that for granted. That's the basis of the empirical, positivist, anomalous scientific idea. We assume that things are out there. Now, the idealists, especially in Germany, the turn of the 19th century, made the argument, in fact, that that is not true. Fichte, Schelling, Kant, I mean, and then, of course, synthesizing that into Hegel and then Schopenhauer, who, you know, they were writing at the same time, that we don't know what's out there. All that we know is what our mind communicates to us. So you cut out the middleman and you assume that we don't know what's out there, but we do know that our mind presents something to us. That presentation is called phenomena. And that's the heart of idealism. You know, materialism just assumes that everything out there is out there and we understand it directly. We put it together. An idealist says we have no idea if we know if something's external to us. It is our mind that tells us things, not necessarily what's out there. When you think about trying to prove the proposition that things external to us are in fact external, and it's ridiculous because you'll just go in circles. So as far as Frank is concerned, and a whole bunch of others to this, both East and West, that Immanuel Kant was incorrect. He was right to attack dogmatism, but he was incorrect to say that there is no actual external reality that we could know, that we can only know what the categories implanted in our mind, inherent in our mind, tell us, that it's constructed, not real. It's constructed. So what is real? What is actually out there? And Kant has no answer. The thing in itself has no existence. People like Fichte said, no, the thing in itself is, in fact, the ego, the mind. And then Hegel took that in two extremes, as you all know. So, what is, in fact, real? The central core idea, and this is true in the most general sense for all idealists, is some concept of self-consciousness. You see this everywhere. German philosophy in the 19th century, you see it in idealists to this very day. What is external to us is more or less constructed, but constructed from what? Either their categories or simply ourselves, how we're created. Our sense of self, the very fact that we can ask the question, is there something out there or not, the very fact that we can ponder this and analyze it, what is assumed there? The one thing that you have to assume, if you don't assume it, it's a blatant contradiction, is our own consciousness. Not necessarily our own existence. I mean, that doesn't say very much. But the fact that we could even consider that. We are conscious of things around us. We're aware. We perceive. Obviously, you can't deny that without blatant contradiction. That's a little bit different, though, from Descartes or even St. Augustine. But if it can't be, if it has to be assumed, I mean, if you don't assume it, you are contradicting yourself, because you can't say that you're not aware, because the very fact in denying awareness means you're aware. That also means it's precognitive. It exists prior to anything. It also means that it's not a thing. It's not an object. It's from here that he builds his conception of God. In fact, we'll go so far as to say we know for a fact that the spiritual world exists and that these powerful, infinite spiritual elements exist because of our own self-consciousness or consciousness in general. This is the heart and soul, not only of idealism, especially of Simon Frank's idealism. Self-consciousness can perceive everything. What is it? What is this field of vision that we have where we can perceive the planet in a way? Whatever we want in tremendous detail over time. Never mind a collective self-conscious consciousness. That in and of itself is not a thing. It is the foundation of things. And of course, it has to have a source. And this is where people like Fichte, who came immediately after Kant in Germany, didn't want to deal with. I was getting my MA at St. Louis. I was really obsessed with Fichte for a while. Reality for him is something that's projected onto the world. And we make these adjustments given the fact that we're all, you know, individuals with the same ego. But that's not very interesting to me. The thing in itself for Fichte was the ego. Frank doesn't accept this. In fact, he rejects the whole concept of modernity because it sees our selfhood as a thing. It's not a thing. It exists prior to things. And therefore, whatever has constructed that must be prior to everything, and therefore infinite, and therefore God himself. Because of this, the world, that is to say, everything that we are capable of perceiving or understanding, this isn't a universe of things. That's something also that's created. And there he, you know, to a great extent, accepts Kant. It's a set of meanings. This is something that even Wittgenstein and Heidegger, to be very simple about it, will also accept. Objects exist because of meaning, not the other way around. And that could be taken to extremes. But meanings matter far more than the contours of whatever it is that we're perceiving, including things like emotions and instincts. Each act of cognition, any time we're conscious of something and think about it, you have a rational aspect to this, inherently. These are specific things and their attributes. These are objects that to which we attach meaning. And meaning, of course, really, to a great extent, creates the object, as something Berdyaev would say. The attributes of things that we perceive around us. But inherent to that, and something that modernity, even the late medieval era, didn't grasp, that there's a non-rational aspect of any aspect of cognition. And that's everything else. This is why self-consciousness is so important to Frank and his understanding of, you know, how to build not only the existence of God, but the necessary existence of God. And that's a quote from him. The non-rational part is, and it's, I shouldn't say it's not non-rational in the sense it's irrational. It may be super rational. When you concentrate on something, anything, either your internal emotions or anything external, whatever it is that you're worried about, the assumption there is that I'm now abstracting this thing from everything else. There's an entire universe out there that I'm not paying attention to because I'm concentrating on one thing or one group of things. So it's X plus everything else that's out there, the infinite. And when we study anything, we study it inherently with the background of everything else. Therefore, that everything else is far more important and that everything else impinges on the thing that we're discussing. That means anytime we discuss one thing, we're distorting it. This is why meanings are more important than things. The idea of consciousness is in fact an aspect of this everything, this all, this world. It's implied in every single act of thought or every single act, period. And it's part of what human rationality is all about. One thing, and this has come up many times, I've done several lectures on Nikolai Berdyaev and many writings on him over the years. And this has to do with the fact that there are no such, that meaning is far more important than things. Meaning is prior to things. Reason, in the way that we normally use the term, is very limited, you know, in the modern empirical sense. Empirical life, that is to say, the objects that we see and feel and study and worry about, they're not so much inherent to the world or our consciousness of the world. They're created by our own desire. They're created by our will. This was central to Berdyaev's existentialism. The minute you start believing that physical objects are really there, and now you have to worry about them, their interrelations, how they affect you, you have now fallen into conformity and irrationality. Objects are secondary because there's something that's primary, at least primary, and that is desire and will. And it's a perversion of meaning. Now, of course, self-consciousness is even more prior to all of that, and that which is capable of creating self-consciousness is the ultimate ground. And that, of course, is God himself. Something that Berdyaev and Frank completely agree on is that we know of the existence of human freedom via self-consciousness because our inner life, our inner contemplation and thought is free. People like Pamphil Yokevich, who I strongly recommend, I don't think there's anything on him in English, makes the argument that we know materialism is invalid because if it were real, first of all, it's a universal and no nominalist can accept the universal. It's totally non-scientific because it's saying everything that is material, which is beyond the ken of scientific opinion. That's pre-scientific or pre-cognitive. But that would mean that our inner workings of thought would be completely uniform. No different than the growth of a flower, the growth of a, you know, the development of rocks or anything else. That would be totally uniform and mechanistic. But there's one thing that we know is that our self-consciousness, our inner life is anything but regular. In fact, it is wildly irregular. It's irregular because it's free and we don't yet know how to discipline our thought. The whole idea of collecting our thoughts, of being alert and keeping vigil in the Orthodox ascetic tradition is to keep those thoughts from wandering, to keep them from this abstract revolutionary freedom that gives them no purpose, so they're all over the place. Everything seems to be a dream. This is the center of surrealism. Our inner life is free. Things external to us, these material things or things that derive from material things are not free. Therefore, self-consciousness and freedom are two sides of the same coin. And it is the sub-rational drives, you know, will and desire and everything else, passion, that creates the physical object. Now, despite having that in common with the existentialist, Frank will say that being precedes cognition. You know, the existentialist argument is that existence precedes essence, which is another way of saying our self-will is primary. Objects in space and time are secondary. That is not the case here because of the nature of self-consciousness. All right, Will. Oh, you stop back there. Sorry. That's one of my canines. It is our will that not only solidifies everything around us, but cuts being into fragments. The concept of knowing, I started this thing off by talking about what it means to know. I said it's an inner awareness within the context of self-consciousness, an empathy, a care between us and whatever out there is important to us. But what I mean by that is that we give meaning to things. Adam in the garden was given the power to name the animals around him. Of course, that doesn't mean he called them Fred and Phil and Joe. It's ridiculous. That's knowledge. It's the knowledge and understanding of everything around him. That knowledge grants a certain level of power. And with a pure will, that power is perfectly legitimate. But when we consider anything like that, we understand that this is a tiny little slice of the whole. It's an object. It is a deformation because it's only this little speck of being in this almost infinite world around us, God included. And one of the reasons, I remember, you know, the theory of evolution predates the revolution of all types, the anarchism, Marxism, everything else, because it believes that matter contains everything. The problem the Frank sees here, that evolutionism implies that matter inherently contains everything. Well, here's the problem. The laws that this theory assumes exists in the world, in the natural world around us, that is not inherent in things. That law is separate from objects, because objects are always changing. They're always evolving. Species are, you know, limited terms and limited ideas. They don't actually have meaning. Therefore, the laws of evolution themselves can never evolve. They have to exist at the dawn of time. And this is a pretty deadly problem for evolutionism, since where did this law come from? This law had to exist at the same time the first speck of matter ever came into existence, or else the whole evolutionary theory falls to pieces. Now, I've made the claim, and I make it here again, that Baruch Spinoza, great philosopher of the Renaissance, a Judaic philosopher in Northern Europe who was thrown out of the synagogue. I believe that he was thrown out of the synagogue because he became a Christian in secret. And Frank tends to think the same thing. I was always impressed by Spinoza, despite him being of immense complexity and difficulty. He was a mathematician. I found his approach to the world satisfying. I was able to almost become attuned to it right away. God and substance with a capital S are one and the same thing. And again, this is theology from a mathematical point of view. But the truth of God, therefore, lies in philosophy. No, I don't accept that as such. Of course, philosophy is a huge primal aspect of this. But the truth of God isn't entirely contained in it, certainly. It's one way to approach it, however. But for Spinoza, he can't go beyond mathematics. Therefore, substance is everything that exists or can exist. Substance can be broken down into two attributes, also infinite. And that is body, you know, meaning the material, and thought. Thought about the material. And he's saying that this is two sides of the exact same coin. And there are infinite modes that break those two even further down. And you create almost a set of categories. He doesn't get into it in great detail, but you understand all three are infinite. All three are the same thing. All three derive from substance. And therefore, you have a concept of the Trinity almost precisely. Substance is infinite. The attributes are infinite. You know, matter and thought. And the modes that derive from each. Then, of course, there's non-infinite modes, which are the objects around us. But they're all infinite and they're all one. But yet they're three. Substance and then the attributes are, in fact, logos. And Frank, and actually I got this from him, where Spinoza, at some level, had become a Christian of one type or another, because this substance attributes mode was way too Trinitarian for anybody. And among many other things, this is why he was removed and sort of excommunicated, so to speak, from the synagogue during the Renaissance in the Netherlands. Concepts remain distinct, but the modes are not. The idea is, you know, in Logos we have the Father, which is the ground of all being. Logos, which derives from him, contains the forms of everything. Now, from this, and this is where we get into the what he calls the self-evident truths of being, deriving directly from Spinoza's strange Trinitarianism. And the first concept, the first self-evident truth, we've already touched on, that consciousness, the knowledge of being, is indivisible. Consciousness, self-consciousness, takes everything into itself. Because it's not an actual thing, it can't be divided into anything. It is essentially an infinite unit manifest in the human person. This is self-evident, he'll say. This is not something you can argue about, because it lies at the root of any argument in the first place. You can't make an argument without all of this, which is something that has to be taken more seriously. You know, we can argue about the existence of the forms or matter or God or anything like that. But then there also has to be the idea that what do we assume is true before we can even make an argument about anything? If things like, you know, logical regularity, that the universe is rational, that kind of thing, that an argument is worth making in the first place. And there are objective realities there. That consciousness, self-consciousness, we've been talking about it, is fixed. That aspect of things is not chaotic. It is only one thing. It can only be one thing. Now, what we do with it can be very chaotic. But the idea of consciousness itself is untouchable. It's undeniable. It doesn't change. It's singular only in the broad sense. It's not singular. It's not plural. It is beyond any conception of those terms. Therefore, this inner being, which is free, which is spiritual, which is infinite, is undeniable. And therefore, the next question is, then where did it come from? What is so powerful that it can create that? It simply can't be refuted without refuting existence as such. Even doubting its truth, questioning it, assumes its existence. This is what the nature of contradiction is. The law of contradiction works because, and I've said this when it comes to the idea of language in the nation. I've said it relative to the concept of individualism. If you're going to defend the ideology of individualism, what do you have to use? You have to use arguments that were the creation of people long before you. You have to use language you did not create. You're in a logical context you did not create. In fact, everything that you're doing in arguing for individualism is an inherent attack on individualism. Because none of these things are individual. They come from a tradition. They come from centuries ago. You didn't invent this stuff. Yet individualism assumes that the individual will is inherently independent. And even arguing for it means that it's not. The very act of arguing for your own independence forces you to rely on things that you didn't create and in fact prove your dependence. And that's the nature of self-consciousness. That's why it's so essential to Frank, and why someone like Spinoza, in that scheme of the, I can't get into Spinoza in any detail, I have elsewhere, forced him to look at the Trinity as God, not as this lump in the Islamic sense, or in the materialist sense, the material world. Remember, the evolutionist comes from alchemy in the sense that each hunk of matter contains everything else, because it can evolve into it. This is what alchemy was initially based on. Another way of putting it is that consciousness is super empirical. Most of the time, we're not even aware of it. We have to be, obviously it's there, we couldn't function at all, we couldn't think, we couldn't do anything. We often take it for granted. We don't even ask, what is our consciousness of things, our consciousness of self? What is that? It isn't a thing, but it has to be something. And yet, how is it able to contain everything we perceive? Every thought, every act, and yet inherent to us as a paltry human being? That's the essence of Frank's thought, and that's the essence of a Christian idealism that came from the decay of materialism in the 19th century in Russia and everywhere else, really in Germany as well. It almost seems like for Marxism and anarchism, empiricism is just a weapon to use against any kind of spiritualist saying that there are other goods other than in production. And production is the only thing that, Marxists care about. But even beyond that, empirical life, that is to say, the objects and things that we see around us at any given moment, none of those contain truth in and of themselves. We have to create a schema that is non-empirical and then put facts in it. That may bring us to the truth, this coherent, you know, formal idea. But even from a moral point of view, there are no objects that in and of themselves give us what we seek. We seek certitude, and we seek repose, rest without having to worry about an ending, what, you know, the concept of heaven. This is what everyone seeks. Every act of being, every act period, every act of thought has those two things as its final end. And if you've abandoned them, then you fall into irrationality. You fall into hedonism and all the rest. And Frank will go even farther. He'll say that for something to actually and really exist, that implies that whatever that thing is has to be irrefutable. Therefore, things exist due to consciousness, and things exist due to that which can create and is strong enough to create consciousness. If, in fact, it's true that in every act, every rational act, that we're seeking certitude and at least a freedom from pain that won't end, because we don't want to even find a pleasurable state where we're happy and we're satisfied, knowing full well that tomorrow it can all fall apart, that creates even more anxiety than if we didn't discover that in the first place. But where do those drives come from? It's certainly not to be found in empirical life. It's not to be found in the world around us. It's not to be found in anything, really, that we could put our finger on. The drive for certitude, where did that come from? Where did this impulse? No one likes being unsure. We want guarantees. Where did that come from? It had to have come from a source that's not worldly, because nothing in the world implies that. And the same thing goes for this, I don't even want to say the word pleasure. I mean, pleasure is a legitimate philosophical topic, like in Plato's Philebus, but a satisfaction, repose. There's nothing more enviable than someone who has a certitude in who they are and who is satisfied in what they are. Now, of course, that's never complete, but that is an enviable state. Unfortunately, in our day and age, those two things are further away than ever. Because we live in an era of utter chaos and oligarchy. And let's go even further than that. Frank makes the argument, or makes a statement, I should say, that something that is temporary, an object, anything material, anything that could come to be and go away, is identical to it being meaningless. Therefore, truth and being are the same. That also implies that perfection, being, and truth are the same. Because truth is that which doesn't require anything else to exist. God is the one object, or I shouldn't even say object, God is the one entity that doesn't need anything else. We need everything. We need, you know, food, and we need drink. We need support. We need oxygen. We need, you know, this incredibly complex array of things, and that's the, you know, one cause of our anxiety. And again, this is also very Heidegger and the kind of thing coming from Heidegger. This is you know, and so that's what, when I say perfection, I don't mean without flaw. Rather, something that's in need of nothing, nothing outside of it. All of these terms, again, this is a Heidegger linked, I can't say that word, sorry, linked concept. That perfection, wanting nothing, or needing nothing, I should say, truth, being, and of course consciousness, are one object. And that derives, to some extent, from Spinoza. Because there's no truth in empirical life, life has its meaning elsewhere. If you're going to make the claim like the nominalists do, that there is nothing else. There's no universal truth outside of your own demands. And this is, you know, the capitalist idea, the Marxist idea, the anarchist idea, the modern idea in general. Then, well, the first question is, what's so good about your demands? But where is this coming from? Where's the idea of goodness in the first place coming from? And why should I listen to it? A man who owns everything is no less anxious than me and you. In fact, the wealthier the man is, usually the more problems he has. Knowing full well that just one lawsuit, or even one natural disaster, economic depression, can sink him. This has happened too many times in the past. You fall out of favor with the regime, and you're gone. In other words, temporal ownership, temporal control, has no connection. I didn't even talk about happiness here. I'm talking about basic contentment and basic a lack of anxiety, a repose. Therefore, the meaning of our existence, the meaning of thought, has to derive from outside of us. And certainly it can't be anything that comes to be and passes away, like the things in our material life do. That doesn't make any sense. We want to go farther than that. We want to go beyond that to certitude and a repose, a pleasure that doesn't have any threat hanging over it. That does not exist in the empirical world. And every time there's some ideology or revolution or idea that promises that, and they all promise that, they promise some form of utopia, it's the very opposite of what they promise. And it's usually very cynical, and it falls to pieces. Because it doesn't exist in the natural world, they have to try to force it on the natural world. And hence, you have various forms of totalitarianism, including our liberal capitalist version, which is far nastier than others that have come prior to it. Frank defines modernity, really the scientific nominalist modernity, as a perception, a conception of nature being brute force. Many of you who have been listening to me a long time probably can't count the number of times I've made a similar claim that the modern idea of simple brute cause and effect is a miserable failure. There is no truth there. There's no rationality there. It's a wild assumption based on what eventually became modern industry. And if that's true, if their claim is true, then what does that mean for us? We're as much a part of nature and cause and effect as anything else. Well, there's always this elite that are beyond cause and effect. The mind, the pentagram, the top of the pentagram. That tiny elite that are free from this cause and effect. The golden people, as the alchemists and under the Medici would claim. They're different. Everyone else is leaden. Comes from Saturn, the simple mass, which had to be brought into being as modernity came from the destruction of the Renaissance in the Middle Ages. You have an X and a Y. You have a me and a you. You have one object and another. What holds them together? I mean, they're both objects, right? They might be both material or both emotional or both spiritual. To even discuss them at any level, we have to assume and imply the all, as I mentioned already. That is this primordial unity that joins the two. And this is central to Hegel as well. Our understanding of the world, this modern battle, is a struggle of the inner and the outer senses. The inner and the outer world. Freedom and unfreedom. Now, in social life, we realize something. We realize that most people, through no fault of their own, still kind of assume that the meaning to their life could be found in the external world. If I just get the woman I want, if I just get the promotion I want, if I just get the money I want, if I just get the car I want, things will be better. And I have this to look forward to. And so they fantasize about what it would be like to have those things and oh my God, how much happier I would be. But understand, it's a fantasy. It's something that exists in their mind. It's something they invent and then impose on the world around them. So what happens? They get those things. The woman they want, the car they want, the job they want, the money they want, the family they want, the house they want, and all that together. And they discover that the fantasy was just that. It was something that they invented, which today, by the way, is helped through advertising. And it's just a fantasy. None of that happens. In fact, now you have more responsibility and more risk than you ever had before. In social life, we realize that while man contains self-consciousness and the rationality that comes from it, we are not always rational. The best of us are not always rational, for better or for worse, and therefore law has to exist. The idea of law is to mitigate the effect of human irrationality, even something along the lines of impulse control, let alone anything more serious than that. Capitalism relies on impulse, a lack of impulse control. We have a whole impulse buying section of the store. That's the entire concept. The whole notion of advertising, the whole concept of these stupid jingles and liberty and all this other crap, is to override our conscious, rational thinking. That's the entire regime, trying to associate products with, I don't know, sexuality or being accepted or being a man or being a beautiful woman. This is meant to override our rationality. There is nothing rational about the modern scientific agenda, whether it be the nominalist or the economic or the political side. And yet they'll assume that when they try to defend it to others. Law, given everything we've said, the real purpose of law, especially under a monarchy, is to take the chaos of the external world, to take the swirl of cause and effect and attributes and violence that confront us every single day and attempt to create a unity out of it. That's the purpose of law. Now, that can only be a minimal foundation. And if law doesn't do that taken together, then it's a failure, and hence illegitimate. Simon Frank makes the argument that in the pre-Christian Greek polis, where, you know, the end of which was Plato and Aristotle, but prior to that, it was driven by a concept of the greater good. But the problem with it was that it was an outer good. There's an I, and then there's a you. Those things, and Hegel goes on and on about this with the master-slave dialectic and everything else. The I and the you are normally opposites. It's competition. The existentialists are, you know, swoon about this stuff. And I say, and Frank to some extent says, the solution to that, the I-you problem, is the we. The other is not the other anymore. I see myself in the other. And that is, in fact, the nation. It isn't merely a linguistic connection, although language covers everything, all kinds of interaction and thought, but religious, moral, and political. And the monarchy represents the unity of all of these things, the unity of being, the inner, the outer. That's why it's so absolutely important to Christian ethics that the crown exist. Freedom can be found in the we, not in the constant fighting between the me and the you. It's a third entity. It's not just a matter of individualism or collectivism. I've heard libertarians go on about this stuff. There's only those two things. They can't seem to count past two. Because if that's the case, then we're doomed. Then politics is worthless. There's no point to it. Politics now is just arranging the bank accounts of the regime and the justification and the hypnosis and the images and the fantasies that they promote to justify themselves. That's all it is now, but that's not what it is in essence. The Greek polis, according to Frank, was concerned with the outer good. Christianity came into existence to talk about the unity of the inner and the outer good. And Plato, of course, was one of the first to deal with this, and if not the first. to deal with this. One of the reasons that reading Plato's Republic made me a Christian pretty quickly. Now, the upshot of all that is that the religious idea is not found in a set of rules. The minute you... It's not to say that the sets of rules are useless. Those are only for beginners. That's a way to summarize things, but not the life in general. In fact, membership in anybody can never be reduced to a set of rules. I did my dissertation to some extent on this topic with Michael Oakeshott, that these slogans, these one-liners that we use to summarize what we believe, that's not the whole thing. That's a minuscule speck. It's a summary of a summary of a summary of the truth. Ideology. One of the problems with modern ideologies is that they take these words and these rules into themselves as true, and they never go beyond them. There's no context. There's no understanding. That's the concept with sin. Sin isn't so much the violation of a rule. Sin, it derives from a disordered mind. It's not so much the act that matters. It's the cause of the act. And we know this because sometimes the exact same act can be both praiseworthy or sinful, depending on the intention, depending on the sort of mind that's doing it. Ontology, that is, the study of what is real, is at the foundation of all behavior and of all thought. It has to come first. Will can never come first. You don't have Spinoza, you have Nietzsche in that case. And Nietzsche leads to idolatry and the worship of the will of the strongest, which is what is at the core of Nietzsche. It's not so much that I did my MA on Nietzsche and Hegel in this respect. Nietzsche is certainly respectable in many ways. Especially I did it on Thus Spake Zarathustra. And there's so many elements in there that are worth reading and understanding. The end of that life that was never really spelled out. Same thing for Karl Marx. The end is never spelled out, just the means. It's easy to criticize the bourgeois Christianity of Nietzsche's time. We can do the same now. His critique of Christianity had nothing to do with Christ himself. It had to do with what it had become in modern Germany, modern Switzerland. A disaster, no different than it is today. But existence has to come before anything. If that's not the case, if the whole doesn't come before the part, then our will then is paramount, which is another way of saying the regime is paramount. Religion is never a set of laws because it has nothing to do directly with our will. It's a reality, like Plato's forms. You can't get into an exceptional... I always wonder about the New Testament. There isn't much detail there like you find in the Old. Now, this is all one scripture. The Old and New, that's an artificial division. But merely the identification of Christ as God and man, the manifestation of God in the rivers of the Jordan, that's the purpose. But that's the ontology of Logos and and God the Father, that then governs everything else. Rules are just a very simplistic, simplified way of explaining to someone else what we're basically about. While the ontology of the church and of our national history and everything else, that is not subjective. How we manifest it is. Rules and laws don't necessarily bring context into account, which is why, you know, so many of the great church fathers seem to write in very vague terms. Even, you know, Thomas Aquinas on natural law. Don't expect actual specifics there. The concept is, how do we judge an act? How do we judge it as rational or irrational, good or bad? This is the foundation. That foundation is ontology. The whole always has to come before the part. Otherwise, the worst, the most insane anarchistic egocentrism then has to be true. It's one or the other. You have two conceptions of the self. You have the empirical self. That is, what we do every day, the acts we commit, the mistakes we make. The greatest saints in that empirical realm did all kinds of dumb things. We all do. That has nothing to do with anything. We have no idea what our acts are going to mean, you know, years from now, hours from now. And that's not even our fault, generally speaking. The inner self, though, is another matter. That is where freedom can be found. That's where you can order yourself rationally. Of course, you're going to make mistakes. That's irrelevant. But what is this? What is your order of thought? What is your belief system? How does that connect with the truths of the foundation of reality and self-consciousness and freedom? That's the center. That can be perfect. That can be rock solid. That doesn't mean every act deriving from that in an insane world is going to be good. It won't. Or be useful. We always are going to, this is the concept of always, the greatest saints sinned all the time. There's actually a meme of me floating around saying that. You know, the great saints committed great sins. They say that they were the worst sinners in the world. Were they lying? No, it's just that they may have an internal, a level of internal perfection that never manifests itself in the world because the world is highly imperfect, especially today, based on absolute corruption. Dostoevsky's The Idiot is one of my favorite works of all time. And it deals with what, we could say, you know, the New Testament does the same thing, even the prophetic works. What happens when a rightly ordered soul is brought into a sick, dying, corrupt society? What's the interrelation going to be? And that's why the book is called The Idiot, and I strongly recommend it. The noumenal self is our internal set of understandings. The empirical self, though, that is unfree. That is based on coercion. That is based on all the ideologies of the modern world. The inner self is not touched by that. This is why capitalism, liberal capitalism, is so violent. It's violent because, unlike everything else, it wants to bridge that gap. It wants to short-circuit our reason, our rationality, to create a new man. All revolutionary ideologies had this new man as its core. Well, the hour is up, and I thank you very much for listening. However, there's going to be a part two of this, God knows. Simon Frank, again, the Jewish convert to Orthodoxy, is someone to be taken very, very seriously as a scholar. So many of my ideas of the self and Baruch Spinoza, even Hegel, come from some of his works. And sometimes I actually forget that it does come from him. He needs to be studied more. There needs to be better. If there is an English translation, I haven't come across it. I'm sure it exists somewhere. I tend to read it in the original, which is difficult, but I think more rewarding. There's a reason that Frank abandoned the relatively privileged world of the upper-class Jewish society that he was raised in. And it was a philosophical drive. It was this drive for certitude and this drive for repose that he was convinced only was found in Logos and in Christ. Again, thank you everyone for listening. We'll have part two next time. Bye-bye.